From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Last week, the ABC's Four Corners investigated Sydney's elite boys-only Cranbrook School. That investigation revealed a toxic environment for women, from both some students at the school and from some staff. After further developments, the school's headmaster resigned. The Cranbrook affair has reignited a wider debate about whether single-sex schools are fit for purpose and what can be done to improve how boys think about masculinity. To discuss how we got here and the way forward, we're joined today by Michael Flood, professor in the School of Justice at Queensland University of Technology, and he researches masculinity and gender justice, interpersonal violence, and engaging men in violence prevention. Michael Flood, beginning with the Cranbrook revelations, did the report on the school surprise you, or is this the kind of treatment of women that is quite common within some schools?
Look, it certainly didn't surprise me because this is hardly the first time that stories of sexual harassment and sexism and the sexual objectification of girls and women have emerged, both from schools in general and from elite boys' private schools in particular. You know, I think of scandals about muck-up day, about lists of, you know, sexually desirable girls, poor behaviour on trams. You know, certainly, there's a sort of fairly well-documented history in Australia, unfortunately, of harassing or discriminatory behaviour. What we know less, though, is whether that behaviour is more common among the male students at schools like Cranbrook than in, you know, mixed-sex schools.
So do you think it's particularly notable at elite private schools?
There's an argument that that's the case. I'm not sure, but I've certainly seen commentators argue that one factor driving sexist and harassing and violent behaviour by boys at such schools is a culture of entitlement, a culture that the rules don't apply to us, we're above the law, and a sort of sense of entitlement, including entitlement to, you know, the corridors of power, you know, a sense of being born to rule, but also entitlement to treat girls and women, including female teachers, in derogatory ways. Certainly, there's very good research to show that you get higher levels of sexual violence and domestic violence in contexts where there are norms of entitlement, norms of being born to rule. And so that's the case, for example, in some sporting clubs where elite male players feel that sense of entitlement, that sense of impunity, that they're not going to be held to account for their behaviour. You get higher levels of violence. You also get higher levels of sexist and harassing and violent behaviour in cultures where there's a code of silence, a code that you don't dob, you don't tell on your mates, you cover up and protect your mates. So codes of loyalty, norms of entitlement, local cultures of sexism, of sexual boasting, and so on, they are all risk factors for sexist and violent behaviour. So if they exist at Cranbrook, and I'm not sure that they do, but if they exist at Cranbrook or other schools, they will certainly feed into a much higher risk of this behaviour.
And what are your thoughts on co-ed versus single-sex schools?
A good question. I was at a co-ed school myself until I was pulled out of that towards the end of year eight and put in a boys' school in Canberra. I suppose I would say that there's diversity. There's certainly diversity among single-sex schools, and really it's the culture of the school that makes a difference. We don't have the research to say whether there's greater levels of sexism and sexual harassment by the, for example, the male students in single-sex schools than the male students in mixed-gender schools. You know, most of the research is focused on educational outcomes, on whether, you know, sending your son or daughter to a single-sex or a mixed-sex school is better for them. There's been very little research comparing kind of social outcomes to do with sexism, to do with harassment, to do with racism and so on. But certainly, I think it's unarguable that there are likely to be, at some schools, cultures that feed into sexism, that feed into harassment and so on.
Some people would say that, some people do say that single-sex schools are better for girls and co-ed schools are better for boys. Do you have a view on this? Is there any research on that?
Look, I think there's likely to be some truth in that. In terms of social outcomes, I think there's, you know, at least some small-scale evidence from qualitative studies that that is the case. You know, again, you know, it's not conclusive. We have to be careful about this. But certainly if I was a parent choosing where to send my son, if I was interested in sending my son to a single-sex school, I would be doing my homework on what the culture of that school is. To what extent does its formal and informal culture foster gender equality, foster respect, foster inclusion? Or does it involve this, you know, the kind of traditional norms of rigid, dominant, aggressive masculinity that feed into the social problems that are now making the headlines?
Given what seems to have been something of a cover-up at various levels at Cranbrook, such research wouldn't necessarily be easy to do, would it?
Not at all. And, you know, I think that's part of the problem, that some schools operators close shops where they don't want to be held accountable for poor behaviour by students. And when that behaviour does occur, it's very tempting for the leaders of those institutions to portray this as the function of a few bad apples, you know, kind of isolated incidents. And that was some of the initial excuse making we saw, for example, among leaders in the military when there was the ADFA Skype scandal, when a number of young men at ADFA behaved in an abusive and coercive way to female students at ADFA, the, you know, the Australian Defence Force Academy. But instead, over time, what became clear is, no, this is a problem of culture, and in fact, you need senior leadership and public accountability so that you know, the school or the institution takes whole of institution steps to actually build a more inclusive and respectful culture.
If schools like Cranbrook are to go co-ed, how can they better prepare themselves for that transition?
Look, they will need to work on culture change because, you know, to the extent that male students and staff see girls and women as some kind of foreign species, some kind of strange species that you should either, you know, treat in a kind of patronising and benevolent way on the one hand, or in a derogatory and sexually objectifying way on the other, that will feed into all kinds of problems. And so I think there is work to do for schools that transition from single sex to mixed sex to do culture work, to explicitly foster norms of respect, of inclusion, you know, through curricular in classes, through policy statements at the senior level, and through other kinds of strategies.
And do they have to really crack down when bad behaviour persists?
They do, and they need to do more than simply, you know, punish and isolate offenders, because what's likely in many contexts is that, in fact, that's an expression of a broader problem. There may be in some schools peer groups, entire peer groups that are based on sexism, based on sexual objectification. And the research in boys' schools, you know, to the extent that there's been research in boys' schools, it shows there's often diverse peer groups. There's some peer groups of boys who are friends with girls, who treat girls and women with respect and care. And there are other peer groups that are based on strong norms of sexism, of male bonding, where you get status by scoring, by getting as far as you can with particular girls and so on. And so that then requires more intensive intervention to actually address those particular boys and the peer cultures that sustain their sexist and antisocial attitudes.
Now, I want to move to the issue of masculinity and male attitudes more generally. Why is it so hard to reduce domestic violence, sexual harassment, given how much focus we've placed on combating these?
Yeah, great question. Look, rates of domestic violence, certainly rates of physical violence in relationships and intimate partner homicide, have gone down in Australia to some extent over the last decade or two. And community attitudes have improved. People in the community are less likely to blame victims, more likely to hold perpetrators accountable, more likely to recognise a range of physical and non-physical behaviours as part of domestic violence. But there is much more to do. And one problem is that our efforts among boys and young men are ad hoc and scattered. There are some good initiatives among boys and young men and in, you know, mixed gender groups and classrooms around Australia, but respectful relationships or violence prevention education is uneven, mandated at a state level in some states and territories, ad hoc and scattered in other states and territories. So while there's good evidence that well-designed school programs, for example, can shift the attitudes and behaviours related to violence and harassment, they've not been implemented at scale. They're not yet, you know, rolled out in a way that they're covering the vast majority of children and young people and therefore making change at the level we need.
Now, you'd assume that younger men would better understand women's issues, would have better attitudes than their parents' generation or their grandparents' generation. But is this in fact the case?
Tragically, no, it's not the case. We can't simply assume that young men have better attitudes than older generations of men or other people, because the fact is they don't. So, for example, the highest rates of sexual violence offending in Australia are among young men 15 to 19. They're more likely to perpetrate sexual violence than any other group of men. And young women, girls and young women around the same age, around 15 to 19, have the highest rates of victimisation. And if you look at attitudes, young men in their late teens and early 20s, in fact, often have poorer attitudes to sexual violence and domestic violence than slightly older cohorts of men, than men in their late 20s, men in their 30s and 40s. Young men, the youngest men, teenagers, for example, tend to have better attitudes than their grandparents, but not necessarily than their parents. So if you like, there's kind of a U-shape to violence supportive attitudes among males. It's not a steeply shaped U, but it's a U-shape nevertheless, where young men don't necessarily have better attitudes. We've got good data in Australia from the Manbox survey. The Manbox survey was first done in 2018 and has just been done again with data coming out just this year. What it shows is there's been some improvement over time in young men's attitudes towards masculinity, mainly in the attitudes towards stoicism, the idea that you should never ask for help, the idea that you shouldn't show weakness. That idea has declined. But young men's ideas about dominance in relationships, about, you know, boys and men's roles in relationships haven't changed much. So, for example, the proportions of young men who think that a man should always have the final say in decisions about his relationship or marriage haven't changed much. 39% agree that's what they're told by society. And about one quarter or one fifth of young men distrust women's reports that they've been assaulted, minimize the impact of violence against women, and sometimes will blame them. So it's not most young men. Most young men, you know, three quarters or four fifths have good attitudes towards violence and gender and so on. But about one fifth or one quarter of young men have poor attitudes, and they've not shown much improvement over the last 5 years.
Well, why are these attitudes among this group not improving? What's the impact, for example, of social media? Do you think that we're seeing a coarsening of society and that is feeding into this?
Look, I think there are contradictory trends going on among young men. On the one hand, I think that young men these days do, in general, do have a greater sense, a greater support for gender equality, a greater sense that, of course, you should, you know, treat with respect and care the women and girls around you, indeed, the boys and men and others around you as well. And so there's been a general shift towards the acceptance of the ideal of gender equality. There's been some increase in norms of consent, some recognition among young men of, stalking or controlling your girlfriend as problematic on the one hand. On the other hand, there are trends pushing back the other way. And I think, as you've said, we're seeing harms to do with the damaging impact of sexist or misogynist social influences. Andrew Tate is perhaps the most well-known, but there are plenty of others. So influential men on various social media platforms who are preaching sexism, preaching misogyny, preaching that boys should be in charge, men should be in charge in relationships. And, you know, the ideal man is surrounded by money, bitches, and cars. That's one negative impact. I think another negative impact is pornography. In fact, I think that pornography use is pervasive among boys and young men. And I think that is feeding into a growing acceptance of sexual violence, a growing willingness to try things with girls and young women that they may not be interested in or in fact might find painful or degrading and so on. So I think we're seeing contradictory and mixed trends among boys and young men.
So in general, you're presenting a pretty depressing picture here, I must say.
I'm sorry to do so.
But is it a depressing picture, or are those more positive statistics that you were mentioning earlier to the forefront? What's the net situation here, I guess I'm asking?
Look, I'd say the net situation is mixed. Unfortunately, I don't think I can give a purely kind of optimistic reading. There certainly are some reasons for hope, some reasons for optimism. And, you know, we do see among young men some positive shifts, a breakdown in homophobia, for example, a breakdown in norms of male stoicism and male invulnerability, a lessening of men's beliefs that men should be the breadwinners, women should be the homemakers. There's a greater interest in involved and positive fathering. So there are various positive shifts among young men, but I think there are also some negative shifts, but they are uneven and not universal, and they're concentrated among particular cohorts of young men, the young men spending time in problematic online spaces, young men with male peers with sexist views, perhaps young men in some particular schools and particular sporting cultures and workplaces and so on.
I guess all of this amounts to a perception that these days it's harder for parents to bring up boys, and yet parents themselves are more pressed on many fronts than in earlier times. What advice, Michael Flood, would you give to parents with young sons?
I think parents have an absolutely vital role to play in building up good young men, in raising boys and young men who are ethical, who are respectful, who behave well to girls and women, and to men and boys and others. Parents have a vital role to play, and funnily enough, fathers have a particularly vital role to play. And the first thing I think parents in general and fathers in particular can do is role model equity, role model respect. Try to treat our partners, the mothers of our children, with respect and care, and do that role modeling through the way we talk, the way we share decisions, and so on. A second thing that I think parents can do is have those conversations, and they can be awkward or embarrassing conversations, but have conversations about pornography, have conversations about relationships, have conversations with older children about older children and young people about consent and respect and so on. And I'm speaking in part as a parent myself, a parent of now an 18-year-old son and a 14-year-old daughter, and certainly have those conversations. And these are not one-off conversations. These are regular conversations to have. And I think a third thing to do is to raise those issues around media, when watching TV together or talking about TikTok or, asking about what they're seeing on their phones and so on. And so I think, parents can play a critical role, but it would be unfair if we lump the responsibility for addressing these social problems only on parents. Teachers and schools have a critical role to play, so do churches, so do sporting institutions, so indeed does the government in mandating effective violence prevention and other strategies in schools and other contexts.
Michael Flood, thank you so much for sharing your information and your insights on an issue that so many people are concerned about and so many parents are worried about. That's all for today's Politics podcast. We'll be back with another interview soon. Thank you to my producer, Ben Roper. Goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.